Welcome, welcome, welcome everybody to the Deconstructor of Fun podcast. Today we have returning host, Mr. Eric Suford, founder of Mobile Dev Memo, the primary destination for all the modern marketing professionals, founder of Heracles Capital, an early stage venture fund investing into the mobile ecosystem, and the former marketing lead at companies like Rovio, Wooga, and Network. So Eric, welcome back to the podcast.
Misa, thank you for having me. Happy New Year, brother.
Thank you. Thank you. How's the winter treating you? Because you're now almost at the same altitude, so you've been enjoying that minus 20 Celsius.
Yeah, I guess it's warming up today, so it'll be like minus 5 heat waves. And so I'm currently in Estonia, which is where my wife is from. And we got here like mid-December. We're going to be here till February. So we're here for quite a stretch. And we got here, the weather was pretty nice. It was like just below freezing, so it's kind of nice and crispy. There's snow on the ground, and then the temperatures plummeted to extremes that I don't think I've ever felt before. Like, we go to Breckenridge, Colorado every year, and it's cold there, but I don't think I've ever felt a temperature that cold. I mean, it was like minus 26 one day. It's so cold that like the temperature in centigrade and Fahrenheit like converges. Like, there's not that much of a difference. That's how cold it was. But yeah, it was very cold. I'm not having much luck with weather for the last 12 months, because we had like the most brutal summer in my lifetime in Texas. It was like 105 degrees plus for like 60 days in a row. And then I came here and it was minus 20. But it's warming up. It's going to be just below freezing today. And it's actually going to be above freezing later in the week. But yeah, it's been cold.
Yeah, your family is utterly unprepared for these type of colds, especially living in Austin. Yeah, not Houston. You're from Houston, but you're living in Austin.
You should see the park I bought them, because I had projects right before we flew out here, and so I had to be in San Francisco, and so I flew back, and I like the next day we were leaving, so I packed like very quickly, and I just threw a bunch of stuff in a suitcase basically, and I packed a shell jacket. So, you know, I had like a Patagonia jacket, which is just a shell. Yes. Not, you know, it plugs into like an under jacket. And I only packed a shell. So I was just freezing. So I was like, one day it was minus 26. Like, I was like, I got to upgrade my jacket. So I went to the mall and I got this parka that goes down to like below my knees. And it's so thick that I look like a Stay Puft Marshmallow Man walk, but it's so warm and comfortable.
No, this is the place where you need to wear your Canada Goose, but, We're right. Not here to talk about that, even though those are. And you actually went to see the sauna class. I want to hear about that more. But we're here to talk about the mobile app predictions. I know people want us to jump in right into the topic. And you've been writing these for, I think, almost a decade now. The predictions for marketing.
Yeah. So I'm publishing. Since like 2013, I've been publishing predictions. I've done 9. Mobile gaming predictions, including this year's, which will have been published one day before this podcast goes live. And I think I've done 8 mobile marketing. So over the last 10 years, and some years I alternate, and some years I do one and not the other. But yeah, so in total, I've done 9 mobile gaming predictions and 8 mobile marketing predictions throughout the year.
Yeah. And in this podcast, we're going to go 5 out of the 10 predictions you're going to make in all together. And for folks listening, I'm just going to ask dumb questions because I don't totally understand things, but I'm sure the other people are much smarter than myself listening and they want to dive deeper. They should go to mobiledevmemo.com. And I believe these predictions are for subscribers only, because you launched the subscription tier, and that will have a lot of details, a lot of insights. And I'm sure that you will need to go kind of back to a lot of these statements being made here to kind of, you know, reach that, to check them again over the year. So definitely suggest that people subscribe to Mobile Dev Memo.
Well, thank you for suggesting that. But yeah, let's dive in.
All right, prediction number 1. Let's just go into it. So no more shilling. Actually, no. We got to do one more shilling. We're doing an event. You are doing an event in Pocket Gamer Connect. I'm doing an event in Pocket Gamer Connect. So on Monday, 22nd of January, there's going to be Mobile Dev Memo Happy Hour. It's a short walk away from the brewery where the Pocket Gamer Connect is happening. That is at 6 p.m. and it's going to last all the way till 11 p.m. I know Suford is a little bit of a DJ, so you might be getting up.
Yeah, I didn't bring my gear. I'm just going to plug my phone in.
Yeah, you don't travel like Paulie D. What's his name? Paulie D. You remember the DJ Paulie D. Yeah, DJ Paulie D. But and then there's a Deconstructor of Fun event that is right next to the brewery. So just a few steps, you can get your first snacks, a couple of beers. That's going to start at 5 p.m. So if you are maximizing and optimizing your event, you go to Deconstructor Fun, and then you continue your path towards the MDM for the rest of the night with DJ Eric D.
Yeah, the registration link, if you go to mobiledevmemo.com, you'll just see the at the top of the page, it says London Happy Hour. Just click on that and register. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to accommodate everyone. There's limited space, but I hope to give tickets to as many people as possible.
All right. So, prediction number one: Microsoft could launch either a standalone mobile gaming ad network to operate across stores, or it could launch a search ads product on its own gaming app store, similar to those that exist in the app store, such as Apple Search Ads as well as the Google Play. What's this prediction? Like, where did it
come so back? So you remember that Microsoft had to make a lot of concessions to get the Activision deal done, right? And it had made a number of public pronouncements that I believe it thought would endear itself to the regulatory authorities, right? You might remember that they published their open app store principles last year. I don't remember exactly when. I think it was in February. But they basically, they published this list of principles that they believe should guide the operation of an app store, right? And they contrasted in some very significant ways with the app store policy and Google Play policy, right? They basically said, look, if we were to launch an app store, we'd want to foster this open environment where we wouldn't self-preference and we would prioritize our own apps, and we'd be transparent in fees that were charged. And so they published that, and then in March of 2023, as you know, this deal was being held up, they said, look, if the deal goes through, if we are allowed to acquire Activision, we will create our own mobile gaming app store in the EU once the DMA goes into effect, right? So the DMA is the sort of landmark EU law which allows these alternative app stores to exist, or forces the platform operators to allow these alternative app stores to exist, and also forces them to allow for sideloading, right? And what Microsoft said was, look, hey, regulators, here's another reason you should support this deal. If you support this deal, we're actually going to increase competition in this market. We're going to create our own mobile gaming app store. Now, they also said last year that they were going to expand their advertising offering in Xbox, right? They were going to bring ads to Xbox games, right? And so I think if you look at all three of those things, it seems reasonable to conclude that they would bring ads to this mobile gaming app store that they're going to launch in Europe once the DMA goes into effect. I put that first in the predictions because I think that's kind of a no-brainer, right? They already operate a big ad product. They already operate advertising technology, which is Xandr, right? They bought a company a few years ago. It was kind of quiet. I think it was the year before last. It was right before the end of the year. It was during the holiday period that they closed it, AppNexus, and they call it Xandr, right? And that is what empowers Netflix's ads product, is Xandr, right? So Netflix doesn't have its own ad tech. They actually, they have a deal with Microsoft. Xandr powers Netflix's ad product. Well, so they have the ad tech. I'm almost certain they're going to create the mobile gaming app store, right? They had a big sort of reshuffle in the Xbox division. I think they've got a lot of progressive, fresh blood, progressive ideas, forward-thinking people leading the gaming efforts there. I'm fairly certain they're going to launch a mobile gaming app store. Why wouldn't they introduce ads, especially after the deal closed with Activision? Because what does that give them? That gives them a massive footprint on mobile. That's as of the last earnings. So when the deal was under consideration, Activision wasn't publishing financials, but they were still doing earnings reports. And as of the last earnings report they published as an independent company, they said that King had 238 million MAUs, right? That's a massive footprint, across the entire Candy Crush franchise. So just even starting there, imagine that they built this, so in the predictions, I say, okay, either the standalone ad network that would look something like Unity, something like AppLovin, something like, Vungle, either they create one of those and they sort of seed it with their own MAU footprint, which is massive. So that's that 238, that was just King. That doesn't include Call of Duty. That doesn't include the Blizzard titles, which I don't think are that big, but nonetheless, it doesn't include Minecraft, which is for kids, but nonetheless, I mean, they have a massive mobile footprint. Now, what if they launch a mobile ad network? That's a little bit of a bigger lift, but they could seed that with the existing MAU, right? And then, you know, you could sell the impressions that that lead to anywhere. They don't have to lead to the App Store. They don't have to lead to Google Play. They can lead to the Microsoft App Store, right? Now, the other option is they just launch an app store and they have search ads, right? Which is probably easier to implement. That just looks exactly like it looks in Google Play and in the App Store. You search for a keyword and they've got an ad at the top of the search results. But that's my prediction. My prediction is in 2024, Microsoft launches their mobile gaming store, and they also, in parallel, they launch some kind of ad product that allows for distribution even in their own store or across all of the store.
Yeah, it kind of makes the first part where you say they built their own ad network and populated through King and Activision and Blizzard and so forth makes more sense, because I'm having a hard time understanding how Microsoft's own store, let's say if I like a Samsung store, could be, could offer up some kind of a powerful value over what Google Play or iOS store offers. Like, what am I not seeing? Like, what would make Microsoft App Store relevant?
Well, it's Microsoft, right? So they have the wherewithal to promote it, right? I mean, like, here's my, and we might get to this. I don't remember if this is one of the predictions that that I included to talk about in the podcast. But yeah, the issue with the DMA is I think a lot of people are overly optimistic about how much it's actually going to change, right? So I think the DMA, really what it does is it opens the door for like a couple of the largest companies in the world to create app stores. But it's going to be very difficult to compete with the defaults. Right. Unless you have, you know, the balance sheet, you know, the financial wherewithal to promote it. Right. And Microsoft does. Epic does. Maybe Valve does. Maybe Nintendo does. Maybe Sony does. But there's a handful of companies that probably could launch and gain any sort of traction with a mobile app store. And then we'll also talk about sideloading and why I don't I can't remember if we'll talk about that. But we'll talk about the predictions. I don't think sideloading is going to be a meaningful it's going to sort of like be a meaningful consumer behavior in Europe, even when it's allowed under the DMA, right? So first of all, it's already allowed on Android, right? And no one uses it. No app developers, for the most part, don't publish games that way. Very few installs happen that way. And it's hard for me to believe that consumer behavior would be meaningfully different on Apple than it is on Android, where it's already allowed. But if you're Microsoft, first of all, you have the ability to promote this mobile gaming app store. You've got the Xbox platform that you can use to kind of cross-promote and drive awareness. You can do kind of like second screen integrations. And then they've got the Xbox Kinect user base, which as of the last touch point was like 25 million subscribers, right? So they have connectivity to some, you know, this sort of gaming user base. That 25 million is not that much, in terms of the App Store, which I think the last time Apple published any sort of metrics, and I could be misremembering this, but they had 600 million WOWs, so weekly active users. So 25 million is not a lot, but it's Microsoft, right? And, you know, they have the ability to build this. They have the ability to promote it and gain distribution. Now, the other thing they have are their own games, right? So you could imagine that, you know, they make their own games, some subset of their own games exclusively available there. You know, they could push more people to download it. Now, keep in mind, DMA only impacts the EU. And so we're only really talking about the EU here. We're not talking about globally. Mm-hmm. But my sense is at some point the US follows suit, maybe not with legislation, but there'll be probably more through litigation. Right. So the App Store is already, there's likely to be a big DOJ suit filed against Apple this year. And it targets its practices, you know, related to competition. And, you know, one of those practices is, you know, the way that they treat developers at the App Store and consumers. So my sense is this will also, these sort of like competition reforms will happen in the US too. And, you know, if there is a company that can gain traction with an independent gaming store, it is Microsoft. They obviously see gaming as a important priority for them, right? And, you know, they spelled out, like, there were the leaked documents that came out of the regulatory scrutiny from the proposed merger or acquisition. And they had spelled out, there's a memo that got leaked, and it said, yeah, gaming and advertising are two biggest priorities for the company. Mm-hmm. Right. So given that, you'd want to have a scale presence on mobile.
Yeah. If I can build upon your prediction, I would say this is something that Henrik Sørensen, founder of Play Venture, or the founding partner of Play Venture, has been made this prediction. I think that, and I agree with him, I think that Microsoft buys Unity. And with that, they get two things. First of all, they get access to ad tech, especially for mobile, and quite a big of an inventory. And secondly, they will make their app store much better, or not much better, but much more viable. Because if they would say, should you publish your games exclusively on Microsoft App Store, we will waive the Unity runtime fee. And now you get to populate it with all these games. And that way becomes a prominent platform. What do you think about that type of prediction?
I can understand why they would want to do that. And I can understand why Unity would want to sell to Microsoft. I don't know that they could get that done from a regulatory standpoint, especially if they were operating an app store, right? It kind of feels like you get to do one or the other. You either get to have the dominant game publishing engine on mobile, or you get to have an app store. But I don't think you get to do both. The Unity runtime fee, I think that was so poorly understood and it became such a firestorm that I think it, for whatever reason, the fact that most developers were going to have to pay that was neglected. Like even with the first set of terms, I mean, it wasn't going to apply to that many developers. It was going to apply to the Zyngas of the world and the scale, the Supercells of the world and the Kings of the world. But I don't think it wasn't going to apply to the vast majority of developers, right? In terms of revenue threshold. So they just weren't very clear about it. Like they didn't publish that with a calculator. If they had published that with a calculator, I don't think there would have been near the controversy that erupted. They just didn't have a calculator. So people had no idea what they were going to owe. Because the problem was it was going to be dependent at the geo. It was going to be geo. It was going to be, the fee was going to be calculated by geo. And so you had to look at your DAO by geo, like, or your installs by geo, and then you'd have to calculate the fee, and then you'd have to look at the thresholds. I mean, and especially in the form it takes now, it's like the vast majority of developers don't have to worry about this. Like, I mean, I had startups in my portfolio saying, oh, we need to switch engines. I'm like, why? Build a successful game first. If you qualify for the runtime fee, then let's talk. Then you're doing well. But don't start freaking out, you know, pre-soft launch. About this hypothetical fee that you might have to pay in success.
Yeah, that's well put. But yeah, I think, okay, I got it. The regulatory issues will be, I mean, Microsoft is facing them on all fronts, and that's probably the biggest hurdle to overcome. But, you know, looking at where Unity is going, I think their CEO is former Microsoft. I think he was the CEO of Red Hat that was acquired by Microsoft. And now, yeah. So there's a lot of things that are pulling towards this direction where Unity would find a very nice home inside Microsoft's portfolio. So, but I understand the regulatory issues.
This episode is brought to you by Data AI. Yes, they were called App Annie back in the day, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how Data AI is the first company to combine consumer and market data with the power of artificial intelligence. And Data AI does this to unlock unique consumer and market insight to accelerate competitive advantages across all digital channels worldwide. What we here at Deconstructor Fund really like is Data AI's Game IQ tool. It's this fantastic market and competitive intelligence tool for mobile gaming that allows publishers to really get to the feature level of a game without doing a full-on deconstruction first. Using this tool, your team can quickly tie features to performance KPIs, which will help you make difficult roadmap decisions. It's also a great tool to identify hidden growth opportunities as you can analyze games on a scale. As you well know, there are hundreds of thousands of gaming apps in the App Store and thousands of new mobile games released each month. And while we don't want you to stop reading and listening to Deconstructor Fun, the fact is we can't cover it all. With Data AI, and especially their Game IQ tool, you'll be able to efficiently determine what features provide a lift, make roadmap decisions based on accurately modeled expected outcomes, discover how competitors lifted performance through feature releases, benchmark performance against your competitors, focus with confidence on the highest potential genre for a new game release. We here at Deconstructor Fun are huge fans of Data AI, so what are you waiting for? Go to Data AI and try the service for free.
The games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for Games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for Games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for Games, supercharging the gaming landscape.
So, something you touched upon was the MDMA Act. No, not MDMA Act. DMA.
DMA. MDMA Act.
Oh, just lost it. So, yeah, so DMA Act. And your prediction number two was actually that less than 10% of game monetization in the EU shifts to sideloaded apps or alternative in-app payments as the DMA goes into effect. And something that you wrote that I would like to understand a little bit better, you said, Google and presumably Apple will merely discount the fee it applies to in-app payments collected in apps that are downloaded from Google Play by 3%. What does that mean?
Or off platform, right? So, so let me just take a step back. So do you remember at DOF Istanbul 2 years ago?
Yes.
The first one. And I said, hey, who here in this audience knows what the DMA is or what the DSA is? And no one raised their hands, right? I mean, this has been the law was passed more than 2 years ago, right? I mean, it's not new. And, you know, I published about it then, but I think there's been a lot of attention paid to it recently because the DMA goes into effect in March, right? So basically what happened was with the DMA, they have all this set of criteria that determines which companies are so-called gatekeepers, right? So gatekeepers is a term they came up with that, you know, describes these companies that these restrictions to which these restrictions apply, right? So if you're a gatekeeper, the restrictions apply. So they published a list of gatekeepers last year and then said, okay, you've got 6 months to come into compliance. So that's March, right? So we know who the gatekeepers are. We know what restrictions apply to them. And come March, they're going to apply, right? Like these gatekeepers, you know, will need to be compliant or face, you know, pretty substantial fines, right? And so what they've all been formulating their compliance, right? And so now taking another step back, and I'll get to the point in a second, but there's some interesting background I think that needs to be covered first. So we already have cases where alternative in-app purchases are mandated, or the ability to implement alternative in-app purchases are mandated, right? South Korea, they passed a law that requires that these platform operators allow alternative in-app and off-platform purchases, right? And in the Netherlands, dating apps, right? There was, you know, this case, 2021, I published a lot about it, with dating apps in the Netherlands. The competition authority said, no, for whatever reason, they narrowed the scope to just dating apps, but they said, look, you've got to allow alternative in-app purchases and off-platform purchases. And so what Apple did in the Netherlands case, was said, okay, fine, we'll allow this, but here's what you have to do. You have to publish a separate bundle. You have to implement this modal that when you try to make the alternative purchase, whether it's in-app or off-platform, going off-platform to make it on the web, you have to implement this modal that says, hey, you're leaving. Apple is not responsible for whatever happens to you. It's very scary language, right? It's very prescriptive language. You couldn't edit it for the most part. Similar to ATT prompt, right? It says, look, you know, all bets are off. You're clicking out. This person's gonna process this transaction. We can't guarantee that it won't be fraudulent, and you might not be able to get it refunded. And then you have to implement all this reporting, this extra reporting to tell Apple what purchases were made through these alternative systems. And on top of that, you still had to pay a fee. They discount the fee by 3%. So instead of 30, it's 27. Instead of 15, it's 12. So why would anybody do that? So if you were using Stripe, let's say you're using Stripe on the web to process these payments, right? Or even in the app, right? You got to click on the modal. The user's going to click on the modal that says, hey, look, all bets are off. You know, we can't guarantee that this is safe. We can't guarantee that they're going to honor this. But, you know, proceed at your own risk. Okay, that's already conversion friction. Then let's say they complete the checkout. Yeah, you might use Apple Pay. You can still use Apple Pay. So you don't necessarily need to enter your credit card information. But so let's say you just use Apple Pay. So there's no friction there. It's just Apple Pay, complete the transaction. That's fine. Stripe charges a fixed fee per transaction on top of the percentage of the transaction price. And so, like, I calculated that, you know, in the Netherlands, if you use Stripe to process these transactions, when you account for the fixed fee plus the percentage of the transaction price, it would have been like 50%. Like, the overall fees paid would have been like 50%. And so that's, well, you know, that's obviously much more than the 30% or the 15% that Apple's in charge. And so what developer would do that, right? So we've already got, and they both do the same thing in South Korea. They discount the fee by 4%, not instead of 3%. But they both do the exact same thing in South Korea. They institute all those frictions and they still charge a fee on the transaction, right? And you have to implement these entitlements, right? Like it's in Apple, you have these entitlements that basically register the purchases, right? And do the reporting. And so what Google said was like, look, they published their compliance like a month or two ago. And they said, yeah, okay, to comply with the DMA, we're going to allow alternate in-app and off-platform purchases, but you still have to pay the fee. You can discount the fee by 3% if you don't offer the Google Play checkout as an option, and 4% if you do. Okay, great. So you save 3 to 4%, but now you've got to implement Stripe. You've got to do all this other stuff. You've got to pay the extra fee, right? So who is going to do that? Why would that change anything? Now, the thing is, if you sideload the app, then they have no sort of they have no sort of rights to the transactions because it hasn't been delivered through their store, and so they don't get to institute the entitlements. But then you've got to get people to sideload it. And what Google said, so Google had a big class action suit in the U.S. that they just resolved in September, but the terms of it didn't come out until last month. And what they said, it was this class action suit from I think 30 something states. They sued Google. Google settled. They didn't take the court. They didn't take the case to court. But as part of the settlement, they have to like reduce the two-step modal. So like, if you want to sideload an app on Android, it's like two steps. Now it'll just be one. But they still get to have the warning, right? They had to tone it down as part of the settlement. They're still gonna exist, right? So you still got the scary pop-up modal. But the other problem is that I think just like people are so used to downloading apps through Google Play and the App Store. And I think if you want to get someone to download your app, like from the web onto your phone, which is a scary proposition because it's totally new and untested. Now, maybe over time, this consumer behavior's changed, but certainly at the start, it's going to be hard to do. I think you have to have a lot of existing consumer trust. And who has that? There's a handful of companies that have that. Fortnite couldn't even get that. Fortnite couldn't even gain traction with sideloading. They ultimately capitulated. They published on Google Play because they said the modal prevented us from gaining any traction with the installs, but they were also subject to a lot of fraud. People just started publishing apps called Fortnite, and they were fraudulent apps. They actually had like they had trouble with that. And to say, ironically enough, it was a Google engineer that pointed it out. So, you know, there's a lot of friction to getting people to sideload apps. My sense is, you know, I mean, I'm sympathetic to developers. I mean, I worked for a lot of gaming companies, right? I'm sympathetic to the fact that the 30% fee on one-off IAPs and even the 15% on year two subs, I'm sympathetic to the fact that that's probably not an appropriate percentage of revenue to take in the year 2024, right? Because just having access to the App Store or Google Play doesn't provide that much of a benefit. You still need to support the product with marketing, right? You still, you know, the visual fidelity and the quality of games. I mean, this requires a lot more upfront investment. I mean, I am sympathetic to the fact that level of a fee is probably inappropriately high, but the stores do provide benefit. It's not like they provide zero benefit. I mean, they provide a lot of safety. They provide, you know, editorial curation. They provide easy access to tax reporting and transactions, right? I mean, like these are not trivial things. These are not trivial benefits to provide. And so it's not zero, right? And I think a lot of companies, you know, while they would prefer to pay zero, it's only the companies that could afford to build those kind of tools themselves that are really advocating for that, right? Because I think most small businesses, and a lot of these small businesses, remember, they're not paying 30% anyway, they're paying 15% because both platforms have a small business program,
yeah,
right? That caps the fee under a certain revenue threshold. I think a lot of those small businesses would say, no, you know, this is a fair deal. 15% for getting all of these tools and systems, I think they would probably rather do that than not have the option to access those tools and that functionality.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like there's a lot of things being said about sideloading and how you can directly download it from an ad and it just goes to a web page and download a different app that is not on the store. not probably the biggest businesses, but I'm curious on your take on the alternative payment providers, because with the DMA, you can actually advertise web stores. And we've been seeing that these web stores have been having quite a boom. I've heard of some of the top grossing games actually making these days almost 50% of their revenue from the web stores, mm-hmm. because they've clearly moved their payers to make the payments outside the app. And of course, those are a little bit different than people just downloading an app. They know they've been engaging with the game right. for years, and now they can get more value for their purchase by making them directly. How is DMA affecting those? Like, not the side loads, but more pushing players to make purchases through web stores rather than through the platform?
That obviously already exists, right? It's just that the discovery mechanism is independent of the app, right? Like, this is, you know, so there's kind of two cases that have changed this a little bit. Now, this is meaningful, but this is very different from alternative in-app and alternatives in-app to off-platform, right? Because alternative in-app to off-platform is like, hey, you buy this, click this button, and I'll take you to a web page, right? Which, again, that's the friction there, right? So that's alternative in-app to off-platform. That is what gets allowed by the DMA. Having a web store is already, you know, it's already a pretty widespread phenomenon, right? And it has been for a while, especially like health and fitness apps. Like, if you look at a lot of health and fitness apps, you know, especially now, the majority of their UA spend might be on the web, not even in app. They're driving people to the website, getting them to register there, getting them to purchase there, and then getting them to download the app. But now, a lot of times these are cross-functional, right? Because these apps are much more basic, right, than a game, which you can't really, most mobile games wouldn't be able to be played on the web, right? But that's been a sort of like dominant phenomenon in some categories on mobile for a while, just pushing the transaction to the web. Now with games, like to your point, yeah, some of the top grossing games, I mean, they're generating a substantial proportion of the revenue on the web. Like if you look at Playtika, publicly traded, right? So they disclose this, it's 25% of the revenue generated on the web. They call it D2C, right? So it's an important source of revenue. That doesn't change too much in the DMA, but where that might change is, so there's kind of two cases here that have altered the landscape a little bit. One was a class action lawsuit from developers against Apple that got settled, I want to say it was in 2022. It may have been early 2023. I don't remember off the top of my head, but basically in that suit, they reached a settlement and Apple said, okay, you know what? Where it was previously not allowed for developers to contact app users outside of the app, they allowed that. So now you can collect their email and then you can send an email to them after they've like registered and said, hey, and you say, look, you know, there's this in-app purchase or there's this subscription in the app. It's this much on the web. It's this much. So why don't you click through and buy it on the web, right? So that's been allowed for a while. That hasn't changed, you know, the dynamics of the industry too much, but it's allowed. The other was the outcome of the Epic v. Apple case, right? So if you remember Epic v. Apple, it was decided in 2021 and in 2021, and the judge basically rejected all but one of Epic's, of the counts in Epic's lawsuit. But the one where they did side with Epic was that developers should be allowed to link to account management portals from within the app, which could include, you know, registrations and payments, right? And so Apple appealed it, and it went to the Ninth District Appeals Court. The appeals court upheld the decision. Apple appealed that to the Supreme Court. And now, you know, we're waiting for the Supreme Court to either hear it or just reject it. If they reject it, then I mean, they all side with the appeals court. Epic sued to have the decision go into effect immediately, and that got overturned by the Supreme Court. That got rejected by the Supreme Court. So until the Supreme Court will either hear the case or they'll reject the case, in which case the Ninth District's ruling will stand, which is that Apple must allow companies to link to these account management systems from within the web, from within the app. Now, the question there is, does the entitlement system still apply? Because it might. So if they're just saying, look, you can link to your website from within the app, and on your website, you may be able to make purchases, register, whatever, but you still have to use our external entitlements program, right? That applies to the alternative payments now in South Korea, Netherlands, and soon the EU as a result of the DMA. Now, I don't know. That seems unclear to me. Although they do have an external account linking system for reader apps, right? So reader apps are like this group of apps that are like basically exempted from all these different restrictions in the App Store. They have that carve out for reader apps now where there is no fee applied, right? The problem is, you know, I wrote a piece about this a while back called The App Store is a Game Store. Mm-hmm. Apple's App Store services revenue is, you know, 80%, 90% games. I mean, because basically every other category is exempted. And so I think they're going to try to cling to these fees for as long as they can. One idea I had that I thought about including as a prediction, but I think it's probably not plausible, was that they just increase the revenue threshold for the small business program. Because the thing is, like, once you get that small, you could find like the optimal revenue threshold that maintains, you know, a big chunk of your App Store services revenue while also exempting just like a massive majority of all developers. So if they found that revenue threshold, which is, let's call it like $2.5 million, right? It's like, okay, we're going to lose some revenue from this, but it's going to be like, you know, 0.5% of devs that supplies to. And so you're just going to get a lot more goodwill from the majority of the developer community. They could do that. I don't think they will. But if they did that, I feel like it would achieve a lot. They'd lose a little bit of revenue, but it'd be like the biggest developers that were paying the fee. And so you could say, well, what are you complaining about? You're a huge developer, you're a huge company. But all like the vast majority of like SMBs and smaller developers would be exempted, or they'd have the fee only at 15%, which I think probably would at least gain them like a lot of goodwill. I don't know, you know, so maybe that would be an option. So I don't know about how the DMA impacts direct linking to the web stores, because I feel like then they'd still just apply the entitlements. I think the only way that you get to avoid the fee altogether with the web store is if all the discovery of that web store happens outside of the app.
Interesting. So what you're saying is, just to recap, is that if inside of the game I'm playing my whatever Clash of Clans or Candy Crush and I'm seeing an ad, or when I'm going to buy more lives or whatever it is, they give me two options. I can do it either inside the app, or I can leave the app and go to the web shop and buy stuff from there. If I do that, and if it's promoted to me inside the app, then Apple will come back and basically ask for 25%, and I'll end up paying more because of the transaction cost that will be occurring outside the app. But if I'm just, you know, cruising on Instagram or TikTok, and there will be ad for a web shop to do exact same purchase in an app that I already have on my phone, then that one is going to be exempt of that Apple's 25% or Google's 25%.
Yeah, because Apple had nothing to do with that. That was advertising the web. That was like fulfilled on the web, and it just so happens to be delivered in the app. Apple wouldn't really be able to know about that. How would they even know that it happened?
Got it. So in this case, the CRM systems that these big publishers have is quite important, because if they can directly target the user through email campaigns, that seems to be the most effective, or even text messages, if they have that information through their CRM system, then they can promote the sales and without Apple or Google taking a portion out of it.
Yeah, sorry, I meant SMS, not push, but yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So if you're communicating, and you're allowed to do that now, right, because of that class action lawsuit. But yeah, I mean, like, I think one thing to keep in mind with these companies, it's like, it's hard to get optimistic about any of these changes, because they're going to try to cling to this revenue however they can, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, kind of just from first principles, is Apple really going to give this away? Like, you think Apple's not going to? I mean, like, you know, Google's announced they're going to take the fee, and they've both been doing it in South Korea. But like, you really think they're just going to give up? They're going to give up on this? They're going to walk away? I mean, they're going to fight this tooth and nail. They're taking this the Epic decision to the Supreme Court. Like, they don't want to give anything away, and that's just a link inside the app, which already is going to introduce more frictions than just being able to double click. I mean, one thing that, like, and I mean, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but like, I think one thing that people don't generally understand about, especially in-game IAPs, is like, these are the ultimate impulse purchases. I mean, except for like certain types of games where you have genuine like whale behavior, and you've got, you know, a lot of the revenue is driven through like live ops and competitions and guild play and stuff like that, where people actually make, I think, you know, calculated decisions about what they're buying in a puzzle game. You think if someone actually spent more than 2 seconds considering that, they'd still do it? This is like buying the National Enquirer at the grocery store. It's like, you know what I mean? It's buying a pack of gum that you can eat one piece of and throw the rest away. These are impulse buys. And if you have to think about it for more than half a second, then you have to do more than just double click the side button, are you really going to continue doing it? I think developers are going to see that. It's like, I think some developers, I think, have like, they just deluded themselves into how critical these IAPs are to their players' lives and happiness, right? And how habitual their games have become in their lives versus just like, yeah, I'm on a toilet. Like, I guess I could use this, these extra gems or whatever.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And that's why I think we're seeing the effect already of the web stores taking place on certain genres and not on the certain ones. Like we're right. seeing that the more casual, the puzzle games are doing better than ever. And then we're seeing clear revenue decline in the more core brands and core genres. Right. And sometimes we're not even seeing the decline of downloads. We're just seeing the decline of revenue.
Yeah.
And this is looking at Data AI's data, for example. But then when you start talking to some of these studios behind some of the top grossing games, they're saying that, hey, we are making money hand over fist through web stores these days. Right. We're just not public about it, whatever the reasons are. But, you know, I've heard from, you know, top publishers saying 50% of that game's revenue is coming in. And then when I look at the revenue data of that game on Data AI, it says, like, the game is down by 35%. It's like, I don't know
yeah,
if
exactly.
it fully offsets, but, you know. Clearly.
Well, that's the thing about, I talked about this in the predictions post. So Newzoo said that the mobile gaming revenue is down 1.6, but that doesn't account for web revenue. And my sense is it's probably flat, maybe even up a little bit when you do account for web revenue, because it is the more core games from the biggest studios that can implement that. And, you know, I've talked about this a lot with, you know, related to like the power of these web stores. Is that you can construct any kind of bundle you want, any kind of discount you want. It's so much, the web is so much more flexible of a platform for doing, for building a storefront, right? Because, you know, if you do it in the app, you know, unless you build like a whole custom system for this, but you still have to register all of the different IAPs, right? And so, you know, and Apple expanded the number, but still it's onerous. And then if you have to make a big change, you have to push an update, which takes time. If you want to do that on the web, like you can do anything you want. It's infinite flexibility, right? And so, okay, you know someone's a high monetizer, construct like this really intricate bundle for them that's like very high price point. And for the games that do have that sort of like deep well of retention and that very sort of like flat long-term retention where there's either the competitive component, you know, or the guild play where, you know, it's more social, like that, those kind of games I think are the best positioned to benefit from that. Now on the casual side, well, the casual side is what everyone poured into post-ATT, right? So they can still kind of do distribution efficiently, right? And that's why you've seen, you know, a lot of the casual games, like the sort of the IAPs-based casual games take over the you know, top 10 downloaded and grossing ranks to some extent, because that's where everyone is flooding into post-ATT. And, you know, Candy Crush has, you know, been doing like gangbusters the last 2 years.
Yes.
Because they have the exact type of game that is very efficiently promoted post ATT, whereas all the core stuff, they're basically just you know, I don't want to say exploiting, but they're an extraction phase on the existing user base.
Yeah, Dream Games the same thing, and yeah, no, this is definitely we'll see the correct data when Supercell comes out with their real numbers, because they have to publicize them as being
right.
Finland based. They have to show their balance sheets. They have to show their income statements. And then we can start comparing that to the Data AI data and kind of see what the delta is between those. Because we also know that they're not making significant in-app ad revenue through their games. So that mm-hmm. will give us a nice view. And they have done a lot of investments into the Supercell store. I think they
right.
just hired recently some pretty heavy hitter from Japan to further take the Supercell store to the next level. So that will be interesting evolution, because that's, I think, the most transparent version of that trend that we can see.
Yeah, Scopely too, though. I mean, if you go and look at the Scopely store, I mean, it's pretty extensive. And
they are doing, from all the hearsay, is they're doing extremely
right.
well. But the problem is we don't know Scopely numbers, and it's very hard for us
right.
to compare those. And also Scopely does significant ad revenue. I believe they have a lot of, you know, the Yahtzee games and so forth. So it's going to be harder to find the delta, but with Supercell's, like, whatever, four games that they're making most of their mm-hmm. revenue from, we'll be able to see that and compare it to the income numbers from the filed report.
Hey game devs, are you tired of dealing with complicated payment processes all over the world? Well, Exola's got your back with Exola PayStation. It has a simple, user-friendly interface that makes it easy for players to pay for your games and in-game content however they want. And because the Exola PayStation user interface is adaptive and accessible on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, your players will have a seamless experience no matter their preferred device. Players can save their favorite payment methods for future purchases, and on mobile, even charge purchases directly to their phone carrier bill. On the back end, you can customize your checkout with game-specific integration options like sidebars and iframes, as well as change colors, fonts, and images to make PayStation look and feel like a natural part of your game. Ready to see Exola's PayStation in action? Visit exola.pro/payments-dof or visit the link in this podcast description.
I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs. Building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond the competition. With their Unity game framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward systems to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com.
So moving on to prediction number three, you said that the cohort of 2020 and 2022 of mobile gaming studios, so basically studios that were founded during the lockdown periods, face a fundraising reckoning. And I think this is a very interesting prediction, because I was in that cohort of 2020 and 2020, between 2020 and 2022. And I 100% agreed with the statement already during the slush of 2021. So why do these companies face a reckoning?
There's a bunch of reasons. So one is, it was an absolute frenzy, right? I actually changed the prediction in the edited version. It's 2021 to 2022. So I kind of narrowed it a little bit, but it was just a frenzy, right? I mean, it was an investment frenzy. I mean, you could get three friends together and go raise $1.5 million for a studio, you know, in a week. For that reason, I mean, a lot of VC funds were raised to exploit that moment in time, big funds, and a lot of teams formed just to chase the opportunity. I mean, there was an incredible spike in engagement. I mean, people were locked down, they're at home, people were playing a lot more, they're spending a lot more time playing mobile games.
Yeah.
And the problem is, a lot of teams that wouldn't have been able to raise money when the standards were higher were able to, right? And a lot of teams that were not really equipped to build and ship a game were able to raise money where they wouldn't have been able to, you know, in 2019 or now, right? And you know, the other problem, so that's one problem, it's just I think the quality bar was lower. The quality bar to invest in these teams was lower, and I think there wasn't a lot of, you know, the same kind of rigor for, you know, analyzing the prospects of a team that was applied in 2019 was not applied in 2021, right? So can this team, like, you know, the ultimate question you have to ask yourself, I mean, like, there's sort of like the initial bar to clear, right? Or like, just sort of like the kind of minimal standard to apply to making a gaming company investment is like, can this team ship a game? And what proof do I have of that? Because if you can't ship, nothing else really matters. I don't care about your game design doc or your, you know, the intricate, you know, game economy spreadsheet. Like, if you can't get something into people's hands, that's really hard. It's really hard to do. It's really hard to ship something. Can you extricate yourself from analysis paralysis? And can you ship an MVP that provides enough data to help guide you in making iterative improvements such that you can globally launch it? That's it. That's your task as an early stage gaming startup, right? And a lot of it, I think a lot of teams like Aquana just can't do that, right? And what's happening now is, you know, they're coming to the end of their their raise, their seed raise, or their pre-seed, and they don't have anything to show for it, right? Or they, you know, they've got a prototype, they have no metrics, and the question is, like, are their existing VCs going to write another check, right? And my sense is no, not. And so there's kind of two issues that intersect here. The first is that the standard was lower, so like companies that raised money in that period probably wouldn't have been able to raise money before that, and they wouldn't be able to raise money now, right? The second is that there's just much more uncertainty about the future of the mobile gaming space. There was a lot of volatility. There's a lot of uncertainty because of ATT and because of the other privacy restrictions that are impending, right? So you've got the GAID deprecation. Now, I talk in my marketing predictions. I don't think that's going to happen in 2024, mm-hmm. but you push that off to 2025. The sooner it happens, the sooner that gets clarified, right? So that's actually like a bad thing for the near-term fundraising environment because people are like, well, it's okay. If it doesn't happen in 2024, it happens in 2025. I'll wait till 2025 to write checks in game again. Right, but there's just a lot more uncertainty around the prospects for mobile gaming, and so VCs are being very conservative, like rightly so. A lot of gaming VCs don't have backgrounds in gaming, like they don't understand the space with the same level of detail that like an operator would, and so they're going to default to being very conservative, right? Now, in some ways, they're not because they're chasing, you know, other markets that I would say are probably even more challenged than mobile, like console. Like you're making an overworld console game, you're raising $50 million. You can compete with Rockstar. Console numbers are down. The PlayStation numbers got leaked. 3 million fewer units got sold, right? This year than last year. So, where's the optimism there? But anyway, that's a sidebar. The VCs are taking a sort of like very skeptical eye to mobile gaming, and so they're just not making. They're not, you know, as willing to sort of like make multiple bets in the same company if they haven't, you know, brought any data to bear to help with the decision. And so what you're seeing is a lot of gaming studios, and this is kind of like a late prediction because it's already kind of happening. A lot of gaming studios raised $1 million, $1.5 million, $2 million. They're out of runway. They've got a prototype. VCs are like, look, if you had data, it'd be different. Or look, if you find a lead, I'll invest, but you got to find a new lead.
Everybody knows that's a no. That's a if no. you find a lead. That's a no. Yeah. Let's just say
yeah,
no.
If you find a lead, I'll invest, but I'm not going to lead. Dude, I've seen deals where the company has data. They have good data. They have impressive data. And their lead is saying, I'm not going to lead this round. You got to find another lead. If you find another lead, where they have data. So if you're coming with the prototype, it's just an unacceptable risk. And like, you know, I've had to face the same decision. It's like, look, how do I go to my LPs and say I doubled down on this? Like, how could I do that? I wouldn't be able to justify that decision. And so I think you're going to see like a shakeout in that vintage. Now, I want to be clear. What I'm not saying is the early stage, early stage funding will continue to be as challenged in 2024 as it was in 2023 for new companies, right? So I do think it'll get a little bit easier to raise pre-seed or seed, call it pre-seed. I think it'll be a little bit easier to raise pre-seed in 2024 than it was in 2023. 2023, like basically nothing is getting done. I mean, unless you're famous, unless, you know, you're coming out of one of these big companies and you're basically famous, but, 2024, I think it'll be a little bit easier to raise, you know, your first round of capital with, you know, an all-star team that has proven success before and can demonstrably ship a game. But I think there is no bridge round for the 2021, 2022 companies. Like there's no follow-on, like no one's coming to save you. Save yourself, get data, get the soft launch as fast as you can, get data and prove that you've got a scalable title. That's the only basis on which you'll raise follow-on funding.
Yeah, even the data is very difficult. Like I talk to a lot of founders and they get, you know, different investors ask them for totally different data. Somebody might be asking for early retention. Somebody is asking for later retention. Somebody's asking for ROAS. Like they don't even, like investors don't even know what they're asking and they just don't want to invest into you. Like there's something that is off-putting. So they're just going to throw in random numbers. Random data points that you will not achieve. Like you can't achieve day 30 on your MVP. Like that's just not going to happen. Or if it does, then just take a bank loan. Like it's an amazing.
Right. The mortgage. If you've got like 40% day 30, just mortgage your house. Don't take any VC. Well, that's a problem. And it's like, how are you going to get to day 30 numbers anyway? So, okay, I'm doing UA at $500 a day. I'm buying, let's say I'm buying 500 users. I'm getting cheap, you know, let's say I'm getting 1,000 users. Well, okay. My day 30 retention is what? It's whatever. Let's say it's 50%. So I've got 500 users. What the hell? That's going to be so volatile. You'll never be able to trust that data. 500 exactly. users a day, 30 per day per cohort. Like, you can't trust that data. It's going to be all over the map.
Yeah. And there's something that you mentioned also in the prediction, or I think you mentioned this, was the high valuation. So in 21, yes, definitely. Yeah. 2020, the value, like, more companies got funded, but the valuation didn't quite start going, you know,
right.
bonkers. But in 21, the pre-seeds were like multi-millions already. And when we're talking about pre-seed, so the folks to understand, pre-seed is when you go to an investor or investor comes to you, you don't yet have much. You might have a deck, an idea, or not even right. that. And then the investor says like, hey, I'm going to give you money so you can start going forward already, bringing the team and start working on it. So that's basically the pre-seed. And then seed is when you're really working. You might have a demo that you work bootstrapped or you know, have a more of a plan. And then Series A is when you have traction. That's when you are scaling and you're raising that big fund. So what we're talking about is that those companies that raised pre-seed and seed, either or both, are now having trouble because they haven't had the time to reach the traction and they are not getting resources going forward. But the other element there was the high valuation. So can you talk a little bit about how that is an issue if you got a very big pre-seed? You just had an idea, me and my buddy, the VC came in, said, hey, we like where you're heading. Here's $3 million. That's going to be your pre-seed round. And that puts your valuation at something. Then we raise a 10 million seed. So now our valuation is somewhere around 25 million or maybe 30 million. How is that an issue? And what does down round, which is following, if you make an investment at a lower portion, what does it mean for investors, founders, and employees? So basically, just can you a little bit talk about the issues of high valuation in this climate?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So it's really important. So the down round is essentially when you raise a subsequent round of capital at a lower valuation than the previous round, right? So it's bad for a lot of reasons. It's not deadly, right? It's not fatal. It doesn't have to be, but it's just bad. It's unfortunate and it's not ideal. But the problem is, so first of all, it's optics. Now, the optics aren't that important. In gaming, they're less important. I mean, everyone knows what happened in 2021 and 22. So it's probably less important for that vintage in gaming. And then the other thing is, like, everyone, well, you know, you see these valuations jump if you launch a hit game. So it doesn't really matter. If you take like 25% haircut or something pre-global launch, but you're very, very confident that the game is going to take off and be a hit and be scalable, then that's all that really matters. I mean, you'll make that back up, right? So it's not as problematic. What's really problematic is just everyone gets diluted out, right? So existing investors get diluted out. Like, a lot of times gaming companies have, you know, 3-4 co-founders, and so they're already kind of like squeezed on the equity, and especially if they've taken 1 or 2 rounds, they've carved out ESOP. So it's like everyone's going to get diluted out, and you know, you get to a point where if the down round's significant enough, the founders may not have enough skin in the game to really care, right? You know, and so especially if you took like a $20 million seed or something like this, you're not going to get that even at it. You might not even get that in A, especially if you're, because let me talk about like milestones in a second. But like, so that's the real problem. It's optically, it's not great, but you know, that's not, you know, existential. It's not great for morale because you've got existing employees getting diluted out. The founders may not be incentivized anymore if they get diluted too much, and the existing investors might not, you know, they're going to get diluted, right? And where it could be really problematic though is like where the existing investors don't think it's necessary. It's like, no, okay, well, you don't need to take a down round. So why don't you, I think we can just get this out and prove the metrics out, and then, you know, then we'll be able to raise a round at, you know, flat valuation or up valuation, right? And that's a big risk of what you can't. If you could have taken the money, but you turned it down, and then, you know, the game flops, and now you've got to pivot, and you've got no more money left. Well, then what are your existing investors going to say then? Well, sorry. But so I mean, like, so that it could also just get like very political, right? But so yeah, it's problematic. It's not the end of the world. If you know, I think it's probably better to do it than to roll the dice and just hope you can get the game in market and get the metrics proven to the extent that you can raise the valuation as flat or up. But I mean, everyone knows, like, it with games, it's you know, these things go nonlinear, right? If it's a hit game, you know it fast, right? You know it early, you know it fast, right? And And so, you know, that you'll catch back up with the valuation, whatever you lost, if it really does end up being a hit game. But I think where maybe there's like some lack of clarity with founders is like what the expectations are at the difference, you know, stages of financing, right? So I think, you know, your definition of pre-seed is really good. Your definition of seed is really good. I would say with seed, I probably want to see some concept art. You know, I want to see some concept art. I probably want to see like some sort of like vertical slice. I want to see some code. You have to build something. I want to get a test flight. With A, I think A's are getting done when you've got a game in soft launch, the metrics look great, and you're ready to scale to global. That's what you're raising the A to do. It's like we're raising the A because this game is ready to go. Baked, and it's ready to go. And we've proven it out. We've proven it out in soft launch. So give us $5 million, give us $10 million, and we're going to scale this thing. And we're going to blow it out, and we're going to be making a ton of revenue. We've got like a 2-year scale plan, and then we've also got, you know, game two specced out and ready to start development in a year. And that's what this money is going to go towards, right? That, to my mind, is how you raise an A. And so if you're going with it, you're going to VCs for an A, and you know you're still not in soft launch, or you've done a couple of like soft launch tests and tech tests, but the metrics aren't really reliable. It's like, well, what am I giving you money for, to keep developing this thing? I just don't see those deals getting done. And what does that company do? They either take a risk by cutting it really close on their runway, to try to get some metrics that they think are, you know, convincing and compelling, and then try to get the deal done really fast with like 3 or 6 months left, or they start, you know, 8 months out. And if you're doing that, you know, you've got to have the metrics already. Right. So I think like it's just my advice to anybody in that situation is you've got to cut the team down to the bone, to whatever is needed to get something in the market and get metrics together. Because I don't think anybody's going to double down. Your existing investors probably didn't double down unless you have proven traction. Right. And that sucks to hear. And like, you know, there may be some VCs like, oh, Eric doesn't know what he's talking about. We definitely will. But like, maybe I'll just have to, you know, I might just have to spell out some hard truths here. I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah. That's an interesting point you made. Cut it down to the bone. And I've been seeing that quite a lot. So part of the layoffs that I would believe we'll be seeing this year are the ones that are coming through the startups. They have been already getting lighter, but I think a lot of them will, as you say, go bust and will need to make some radical measures, maybe pivots, and they will go back to sort of a founding teams pretty much. And I've been seeing, you know, VCs have been pushing their founders to tighten the belt since June last year. And I've seen some of these teams go into skeleton crews with founders like barely taking any salary while trying to keep the lights on.
Yeah.
I have 2 points there. Like I have certain companies that I've, you know, invested earlier and they are unfortunately in this point and they might have their game in certain of a, the kind of like an early soft launch and they are really, really lean, like few people left and not that many months left. And I'm almost telling them like, dude, just call it a day. Just, you know, fight to live another, live to fight another day rather than go down with the ship, because I think they could struggle and eat up their savings. And what I'm seeing is like, this is not going to change. So I think, I think there's a point also where you can retreat. I've seen some of the investments that I've made, they've basically, you know, given a portion back to the investors and said, hey, this is not going to work. And then we'd rather close it down now, make it fair to the employees, make it, you know, fair to everybody. We don't have what it takes. So we're gonna, you know, call it quits rather than slam our heads against the wall. Like what's your take on that? Like, is there either or should you always kind of tighten the belt and go to the end?
Well, I think there's a couple reactions to that. One is if you do tighten the belt and you get your burn down significantly, your existing investors are probably more likely to put some more money in. Right. Because if that gets you to the point where you can raise the next round and you know, all it takes is like 250 versus 700 because you cut a lot of expenses, then yeah, do you probably have it's probably more realistic that your existing investors will support you to get to that point. But you're gonna have to spell out the past from here to there very clearly. Right. It's like, okay, we've got 3 sprints left. We know exactly what we need to do. we've got metrics that prove that these are what we need to address. And think with each one of these sprints, we're going to address this, this, and this. And by the time we finish this out, we need 100K, 200K to do that. Then we will have metrics, and that includes UA spend, because we're going to be gathering data, right? We're going to be gathering feedback from the market on the efficacy of our game. And at that point, we will have a case. We will have a case that is that we feel like is compelling to raise another round on. That's a possibility, right? But yeah, I mean, it's a very personal decision, right, to shutter a startup or not. And I've worked at startups that failed, right? It sucks. That is the worst feeling in the world. And as an employee, you feel like shit leaving. You feel like absolute shit. You feel disloyal. You feel like you're giving up. You feel like you're abandoning the people that you worked with for X number of years. But you know what? I've already got so many years of my life that I can, you know, potentially make money in. And if I'm going to spend the next year making, you know, below market to ultimately achieve nothing with this, like, I got to make the decision that's best for me and my family, right? And it's the worst feeling in the world to be a failing startup. And, you know, it's so context dependent and personal. Like, you know, I would never, you know, try to make a prescription there. But like, you just keep in mind, like, you only get so many at-bats, right? Like, it's what I used to say, like, you know, when I worked at these large gaming companies, is that the teams where the game just wasn't improving and it's been soft launch for a year. It's like, look, you get so many at-bats. Wouldn't you rather start working on a game that you think could become a hit versus a game that could be like this middling success story? Like, you only get so many tries at this. You only get so many at-bats. Like, wouldn't you rather abandon this and go work on the thing that actually could potentially be a hit? Because this is not going to be a hit. Even if it gets to be just good enough to go to global and support, it's never going to be a hit. Wouldn't you rather start something new that potentially could? And it's the same thing with a startup, right? And I understand the conviction and I understand the sort of like emotional attachment, but you got to make a decision that's best for like the sort of like long-term well-being of yourself, of the employees who might not make rational decisions because they feel like they're part of a mission, right? Of your family. Like, there's just a lot more at stake than like your pride or your ego.
Yeah, I love it. This is exactly what, it was Harre from Play Ventures kind of told me, like, there's only one way to fail at a startup. And that is not by, you know, trying something and crashing and burning, but it's kind of be in the, in that middle ground where you're not successful.
Yeah.
But you're not failing either. And you're kind of hanging along for about 10 years or something. And you lose on all the potential that you would have, even as an employee, you would have made much more money. You would have, you know, by now have a car and a house, but you were at the startup paying yourself less than minimum wage and really grinding it out. And it's not going anywhere. So it's, you know, I would say like, yeah, that's the most challenging thing, is to know when to call it a day. And it's very hard with some of the founders, because they've so emotionally invested and because there's a lot of fear of failure, even though there's a talk of, oh, fail fast and move forward. But there is, it's awful to shut down your studio, your company, something that you've started. So yeah, something for you know, folks to be critical about, and maybe ask for advice from others and kind of have a third perspective. Is what they're doing something that could work, or are they just doing it for sort of a, given an impression that they will never give up? Because that's that might not be the smartest thing. So
yeah, and also, you know, I think people get they get seduced by these stories of like, oh, we had, you know, 6 weeks of runway left and, you know, the game took off and blah, blah. I mean, like, that's just survivorship bias. You talk to 9 out of 10 companies that were in that situation, they failed. 99 out of 100. And 999 out of 1,000. That's so rare that happens. I mean, they're just the allure of like that, it could all change in a second mentality. Like, that's not strategic thinking. That's not logical. I mean, at some point you have to kind of be logical about this. I understand that you've got your heart wrapped up in this, and startups aren't logical. For the most part, they're not. You know, the vast majority of times you'd be much better off not doing a startup, just working somewhere, right? Yes. And it's illogical often to start a startup, and you know, you can have an amazing outcome doing that. You can also fail. You're most likely to fail, right? But there comes a point where you've got to not let the naked optimism be your only guiding light. You actually do have to allow yourself to be more logical than you had been previously, because I've just seen so many companies get, you know, just get misled by only by only adhering to that sort of like optimistic strain.
Yeah.
Right. Because that's very important at first. Because if you didn't only adhere to the optimistic strain of thought, you'd never start a startup. No one ever would.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. No startups would ever get started. But there comes a point where you have to let a little bit more of the logic in. It's like, okay, what are we really going to achieve here? Even if we sort of like raise another round, dilute ourselves out, like, you know, are we really, do I see a lot of potential here? And I think at some point you just have to call it. Now, I'm not saying like that should be the default position. And it's obviously a very personal decision, but I think it's something that maybe some of these companies in these cohorts should consider. I think another thing is you need to raise enough money to have more than just one, you know, shot at this. Like you need to raise enough money to have a pivot. Like that's the problem with raising like a million or a million and a half. Like you get one bullet in the chamber. You get one shot at this. You get to chase one project. You're not gonna be able to pivot.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to be that 65-year-old waitress in Hollywood thinking that she's still going to get the lead role. Like, give it your all. If it doesn't work out, that's fine. For most people, it doesn't. And I'd rather those people start another startup than kind of grind it out through till they're bitter and and just shells of the positive selves that they were 10 years ago. So I think we're out of time. We went only through three predictions. So Suford has done 10 predictions. There's stuff about mobile attribution. There's stuff about fingerprinting and how the end of that is going to affect the mobile marketing or games marketing ecosystem. I truly, recommend everybody to sign up to MDM, Mobile Dev Memo subscription service, where you can get a lot of insights from Mr. Suford, and most importantly, go through all the predictions. They're going to be very valuable for your business, whether you're a startup or a scale-up or a publisher or any type of modern marketing person. So I think we're good. We're going to see everybody in late January on 22nd in London. Come to say hi to myself. Come to say hi to Mr. Suford, and come hang out with us.
Yeah, let's do it. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate being the inaugural podcast for the year. I'm still a big fan of the Twig podcast, even though I had to retire my mic and hand it over to Philip. But he's doing a great job. And keep up the great work, man. You have it's been awesome to see it evolve and